تفضل يا عم. Finally ousted. And as Matthew Teller has been finding out, the place remains at the very heart. In April 2011, I was in Tahrir Square in Cairo, an observer of the Arab uprisings. Tahrir fi Midan al-Tahrir, or liberation in Liberation Square. I'd seen how members of the Egyptian security forces had put down civil unrest in a pretty brutal way, brutality that was sadly repeated across the Middle East in the months afterwards. What concerned me was when I learnt that key commanders of armed forces across the region had been trained in Britain. I wanted to find out more. I'm Matthew Teller, and for the BBC World Service, I've been looking at how Britain's soft power is being exercised around the world through its elite training centre for military leaders. This is Sandhurst and the Sheikhs.
Emo, turn! Eight.
Britain likes to think of itself as a leader. I'm standing at the gates of one of the institutions characterised as inculcating and exporting ideals of British leadership, the Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst. I can look past a cream-coloured, porticoed lodge into Sandhurst's forested grounds, straddling the Surrey-Berkshire border. Since 1812, this has been where the British Army trains its officers, nowadays in a gruelling 44-week course testing the physical and intellectual skills of officer cadets and imbuing them with the values and ethos of the British Army. It's fair to say that Sandhurst's reputation precedes it, and it has supporters in high places.
Today, there are 21 officers being commissioned from 13 countries. From Afghanistan to Yemen, from Rwanda to Bahrain. Just yesterday I spoke to the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, who said how much he had missed being here. Many have passed out of here and risen to great prominence. I wish you all the very best for your future.
That was David Cameron speaking at the Sovereign's Parade at Sandhurst in August 2010. Dignitaries from Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates and Yemen were there to see close family members passing out. Within a year, much of the Middle East was in turmoil, as what was known at the time as the Arab Spring swept across the region. Links between Sandhurst and the elite families of the Middle East stretch back over a century to the pre-First World War era of British-occupied Egypt. In 1952, King Hussein of Jordan enrolled at Sandhurst, as his father, King Talal, had done before him. 20 years later, he talked about the experience in an interview with the former Foreign Office Minister, Lord Chalfont.
It was a wonderful experience, probably the best period of my life, really. It was a change from being a schoolboy to being a young man. It was a difficult period of time, really, in one respect, that I had to crowd practically three times into one. But nonetheless, I enjoyed that very, very much.
There are always legends from Sandhurst about the drill instructors and the curious names they have for people, especially noblemen and princes. What did the drill instructor call you?
Well, my official name there was Officer Cadet King Hussein.
Yes.
Followed by many other descriptions, if I didn't do the right thing.
Today, four reigning Arab monarchs are graduates of Sandhurst and its affiliated colleges. Hussein's son Abdullah, who is now King of Jordan, King Hamad of Bahrain, the Emir of Qatar, and the Sultan of Oman. In addition, many of the elite families of the Middle East have sent their sons and daughters to Sandhurst. Dr. Christian Coates Ulrichsen is Middle East Fellow at the Baker Institute for Public Policy in Houston, Texas.
Those relationships outlasted the independence of India in 1947 and were maintained up until 1971. But Britain maintained very close political, economic and security relationships with the ruling families that they had developed over the previous century.
Habiba Hamid is a former foreign policy strategist for the rulers of Dubai and Abu Dhabi.
One thing the British were excellent at were consolidating their rule through spectacle, through pomp, ceremony, displays of military might, you know, military parades, shock and awe. They all originate from the British military relationship. And again, it's a very vivid way of consolidating control.
But what is the legacy of Britain's control and its long-standing relationships? At a time of thwarted revolutions and deepening conservatism in the Middle East, do the Gulf's ruling families owe more to Sandhurst than perhaps we'd like to admit? Overseas cadets live, work and struggle alongside their British counterparts. The first term focuses on team building, both on the parade ground and in the field. Term two has an academic focus, while term three shifts from conventional warfare to counterinsurgency and managing public disorder. Intelligence consultant Crispin Black is a former senior instructor at Sandhurst who specialised in discipline and standards.
You're trying to mould them into army officers who can do things like map read and fire a gun and prepare them for their specialist career, whether they're going to become an infantry officer, signals officer, whatever. But I think underlying that is a much more important task, and that is to communicate to people the value of duty, values of things like integrity. There's a kind of honour code about Sandhurst, but particularly trying to inculcate them into cadets from parts of the world like the Middle East, which are tense and difficult, I think is a very important task.
Habiba Hamid again.
So if we look at the current ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid, he was trained at one of the institutions affiliated with Sandhurst when he was very young. And just shortly after that, he was appointed Defence Minister of the UAE, the youngest Defence Minister in the world at the time. And just after that, he had to handle a major incident. It was a Palestinian hijacking on the UAE's territory. And so he took over the command of the control tower and he dealt with it. And some say it was his military training that gave him the confidence to do that and to successfully navigate his way out of the situation. So that was an interesting case study in itself.
Major General Arthur Denaro is a former Middle East advisor to the British government and was also the commandant at Sandhurst when the current Emir of Qatar and the then Crown Prince of Jordan passed through. What do you think the British cadets get at Sandhurst from working alongside the foreign officer cadets?
They would never have lived close by them, have suffered the abuse of some majors howling at them. They wouldn't have had to shelter under a poncho up on the top of the Brecon Beacons in the middle of winter. I think the cadets learn a respect for Islam. There's a wonderful generosity, there is a kindness that we learn about. And there's a friendship.
Sandhurst's own course notes speak of lifelong friendships being forged as individual cadets become a team. Michael Stevens is Deputy Director of the Royal United Services Institute in Qatar.
It's very clear that the kind of training given by Sandhurst, particularly to elite members of Gulf royal families, has been a crucial part of our maintained access to elite policymakers in the region, our ability to build defence relationships in that part of the world, and to maintain our position as the primary emotional power in the Persian Gulf. So you have people that have spent time in Britain that understand a little bit more about the system, made friends while they were here. They have phone numbers, they have WhatsApp, BBM connections to their mates, to their teachers. And familiarity in politics is very, very beneficial, particularly in the Gulf context. Personal connections are the driver of politics, and without those, you can't get very far.
Jane Kinnenmont is the deputy head of the Middle East North Africa programme at the foreign affairs think tank Chatham House.
Obviously, in the Gulf countries, a lot of senior ministerial posts will be jobs for life for senior princes. Whereas in the UK, a minister of state dealing with the Middle East might be in his job for 2 or 3 years. So it's often the senior people in the UK military who actually have the longer lasting relationships with their counterparts in the Gulf.
Brigadier Peter Sincock, former British defence attaché to Saudi Arabia.
Many people, particularly from foreign countries, go on to be very senior in their own country. They either become the ruler, they become the chief of staff of their armed forces, that sort of level. That is very useful for British people who are drifting around the world, as I did as a soldier, and you find people who you were at Sandhurst with or who were at Sandhurst at some stage, and you have an immediate rapport with them. And I think that's very helpful for long-term relationships between the United Kingdom and other countries. For example, in the field of military sales. I think if you've been at Sandhurst as a young man and you then move up through your life into more important roles, you look back to the United Kingdom, the training you had there, the weapons you used, and that does give you a slight fellow feeling as to where you might start to think about buying weapons yourself.
Today, Britain's Middle East allegiances are increasingly valuable as the Gulf countries take stock of the deep and rapid changes from oil wealth and begin to diversify for a post-oil economy.
The balance of power in the relationships has shifted as the Gulf monarchies have become important sources of capital. So you see the tallest building in London being financed by the Qataris, you see UK infrastructure and oil field development being financed by the UAE. So it's an interesting relationship where sometimes there can be an attitude of paternalism towards the Gulf countries, but at the same time there is a desire, sometimes it can even seem like a desperation, to keep them on side for economic and trade reasons.
That projection of soft power seen in London's changing skyline has also been felt at Sandhurst. In 2012, Sandhurst inaugurated the new Zayed building, an accommodation block built with a £15 million donation from the UAE and named after that country's founding ruler. Shortly afterwards, in March last year, Sandhurst's Mons Hall, a sports centre, was reopened as the King Hamad Hall following a £3 million donation from the monarch of Bahrain, who was educated at one of Sandhurst's affiliated colleges. The renaming proved controversial, partly because of the perceived slight towards British soldiers killed at the Battle of Mons, Britain's first combat in the First World War, and partly because of how Hamad and his government have dealt with political protest in Bahrain over the last 3 years.
I've spoken to a couple of people, including someone at the hospital, who says that ambulances have had difficulty getting to the site where there were many injured protesters last night and early into the morning. We heard at least one story of an ambulance crew being attacked by security forces.
Ongoing tension between Bahrain's majority Shia population and minority Sunni ruling elite boiled over into deadly violence in February 2011. Since then, more than 80 civilians have died at the hands of security forces, and 13 police officers have also lost their lives in the clashes. Crispin Black again.
If you were at Sandhurst and value its system, you would have been particularly concerned by events in Bahrain, where a royal or whatever sort of people you want to call them, family of a different style of religion from most of their people, have used internal repression to remain in power. And the use of Saudi Arabian troops to back it up, I think, was also extremely unpleasant.
Bahrain promised a large number of human rights reforms after an inquiry that took place in 2011. So there have been some reforms to the police force. There's been a bunch of prison inspectors trained. There's an ombudsman within the Interior Ministry to investigate complaints of torture. At the same time, you are having people jailed for insulting the king. Penalties for insulting the king, which could be in a tweet, have been increased. And there is a total absence of political reform.
Jane Kinnenmont. Mariam Al-Khawaja is acting president of the Bahrain Centre for Human Rights. Her father was jailed for life in 2011 for his role in the protests.
You would think it should have been something that institutions would then think twice about before taking money from a ruling family that is so oppressive and that commits massive widespread human rights violations. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. And so the fact that this hall would have its name changed from honoring people who died in World War I to honoring a king that is cracking down on people who are demanding democracy and reforms, I think really says a lot about the kind of relationship the UK has with Bahrain, especially when it comes to economic and financial ties.
I was appalled, and I don't think we should have taken the money.
Crispin Black.
We've previously been talking about, you know, international politics, history, how some of these countries in the Middle East work. Those essentially are things out of our control now. But what we can control is how we run Sandhurst. And Sandhurst has a symbolic function. Everywhere you look, there's a kind of memorial to something, a building or a plaque or something that serves as a touchstone that takes you right to the heart of British military history and British military values. And I think calling this hall King Hamad Hall ain't going to do that.
The Mons Hall, King Hamad Hall, as it is now, is a gymnasium. It is only a gym. Why are you so outraged at renaming what's essentially a sort of a shed with a few training bikes in?
Well, I mean, Sandhurst itself is basically a giant shed. You can put it like that. What I don't like having our Royal Military Academy associated with is brutal foreign dictators. If we need a new gym at Sandhurst, why can't we find £3 million from somewhere else?
Sandhurst's response to the criticism is that all donations to Sandhurst are in compliance with the UK's domestic and international legal obligations and our values as a nation. Over the years, they say, donations like this have saved the UK taxpayer a considerable amount of money. Brigadier Peter Sincock is chairman of the Bahrain Society, which promotes friendship between Britain and Bahrain.
The King has always felt that Sandhurst was a great place. Something like, I think, 20 of his immediate family have been there as cadets over the years. And I think he felt he wanted to do something for Sandhurst. The Mons Hall, as it was, I think was getting on towards the end of its useful life, perhaps, without a huge refurbishment. And he volunteered to do this. He then didn't really, I don't think, understand quite why there was such an outcry in the British media. There were riots, but the royal family and the government kept it fairly well under control. There were deaths on both sides. I don't think that it was quite fair the way that what was happening there was presented in this country.
Today, the situation in Bahrain remains volatile. The British Foreign Office says political reform is progressing. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch disagree, citing judicial manipulation and widespread denial of human rights by the state. Training to deal with popular protest forms a key part of Sandhurst's Term 3 syllabus. In this 2012 recording of a training session, cadets are told what to expect on an exercise in managing civil unrest.
Tonight and tomorrow morning, you will embark on your Sandhurst Public Order training package, which for many of you will be the first time you've been in a fight, and for some of you, perhaps may well be the first time you've experienced true fear, and I think for the majority of you, it will be the first time you've experienced burning.
OK, we've got a dodgy-looking character coming round the corner now. Sanger spotted him. OK, you can hear him radio in. He's told the ops room that he's got a suspicious guy. He's got eyes on him.
Stand still!
Major General Denaro.
Could you describe the nature of the public order training that Sandhurst does for its officers?
Yes, it's an interesting question, one which I guessed you might ask, and the answer is not in detail because things move on. But all I can say on this is that the ethical and the moral training has become much more important in recent years because conflicts have become much more complicated. Quite often a soldier will be attacked from behind civilians. We might even be attacked by a child carrying a bomb. And therefore, the decision-making by the young officer has got to be very fine and well calculated.
Is it appropriate for Sandhurst to be training foreign officer cadets in that overwhelmingly military environment as a prelude to then going back and ruling as a head of state in a governmental way?
Well, I would answer that in various different ways. Military training is, at officer level, predominantly about leadership. So my hope is, and my observance is, that around the world, cadets who have been to Sandhurst and are now in various different positions within their own country have been seriously affected by their time with us.
That is problematic because obviously at Sandhurst, while the training might be excellent, they're not necessarily learning about anything to do with the civic values that we ought to find in civically and democratically elected leaders. So it is a relic of the colonial past and it does need to be rethought.
Thinking again particularly about the Middle East, has Sandhurst's training benefited civic society across the Middle East?
It's difficult to generalize because it's actually only a relatively small proportion of the rulers or their top echelon of government who have been through Sandhurst. But I would like to think that some of the good things they learnt will have affected how they rule.
How has that gone so wrong in Bahrain? Could what's happened in Bahrain be traced back to an influence of what the chiefs of staff and the heads of government of Bahrain learnt while they were at Sandhurst?
Not in my view.
According to Sandhurst, counterinsurgency is taught according to best practice. The rule of law is paramount and the use of force must be proportionate and only used when absolutely necessary to prevent wider injury or loss of life. But what happens when old Sandhurst friends become our enemies? In the run-up to the First Gulf War, rapidly changing international alliances caught up with Sandhurst instructor Crispin Black.
I remember being on exercise in Cyprus with a class of cadets that were about to pass out the final exercise, and we got a signal saying that we had one Iraqi officer cadet with us, that, you know, our governments had fallen out and he had to be returned to London straight away. I thought that was a bit unfair. I mean, the bloke had been training rather hard and was a perfectly good officer cadet. So we kind of lost the signal in a draw for a few days and managed to get him through his final exercise. But obviously, when we landed back in Blighty, he had to go. We couldn't lose the signal forever. So there's a paradox there, too. I mean, essentially, Saddam Hussein's regime wasn't great, but there seemed to be nothing at all wrong with some of the officer cadets he sent to Sandhurst.
But in the late 1990s, there were apparent moves by the British government under Tony Blair to end some of the contradictions inherent in Sandhurst's training of overseas cadets. Major General Denaro.
I think they called it ethical foreign policy. And the foreign minister at the time wanted to stop military training for any overseas cadets coming in. And for us, it was potentially hugely damaging because of the importance we put in having a good 10% of our cadets from overseas.
And now the body is being placed under a canopy where the grave...
Ironically, it was the funeral of Sandhurst old boy King Hussein of Jordan in February 1999, which brought home to Britain's Prime Minister just how well-connected Sandhurst was.
And I went out to the funeral as the Middle East advisor, representing the Secretary of State. And it was unquestionably the most powerful day of my life, because coming to that funeral were the heads of state of almost every country in the world. I seem to remember counting five American past presidents. And our prime minister was there, Tony Blair. And he happened to see me talking to a number of different heads of state. And he said, "How do you know all these guys?" And the answer was, because they were at Sandhurst. People like the Sultan of Brunei, the Sultan of Oman, the Bahrainis, the Saudis, they were all there. And I knew them, or there was a connection that I was able to make with them. And I said, and our connections are entirely due to the fact they went to Sandhurst, and I'm now the commandant there.
The May 2014 intake at Sandhurst, the most recent for which we have a breakdown, included 72 overseas cadets. Around 40% of them were from the Middle East region. Sandhurst didn't tell us the fee charged to each overseas cadet, but in 2012 it was reportedly £48,000. If that figure is correct, then the revenue over three intakes a year could be close to £10 million. For Michael Stevens of Roosi, Qatar, putting aside any accusations of dubious records on rights and accountability, Sandhurst's engagement with Britain's allies, whoever they may be, pays dividends in terms of diplomatic access.
There have been issues to do with our engagement with the Gulf states in recent times, but at the same time, if you want reform to come, you have to be standing in the room next to someone to do it. The problems the Americans have seen is that they have been too quick to take a position on certain issues, and as a result have been isolated from the diplomatic arena. And when you're isolated from the diplomatic arena, you can't influence at all in any positive way.
Former foreign policy strategist to the rulers of Dubai and Abu Dhabi, Habiba Hamid.
The broader question of should there be such a relationship given the repression hasn't been answered. No one has looked at that robustly enough to put a stop to the Sandhurst relationship. No one's really put that on the agenda. Many people have tried, many activists have tried, but seriously, there's been no rigorous analysis or scaling back of that relationship. So the trade is taken front and centre.
Jane Kinnenmont of Chatham House.
The Gulf governments already get annoyed that they feel lectured by the UK when it comes to human rights, and they feel that the UK is trying to push them on democracy. I don't think that's the case at all. I don't think that the UK has a desire to see democracy in the Gulf. I think that they would probably like better functioning parliaments. higher turnouts in elections and things like this, but there's certainly no desire to see the ruling families be replaced by opposition movements. I think the British government interest is in trying to make the rule of the existing monarchs more sustainable and more palatable.
Relationships forged at Sandhurst certainly benefit Britain's military establishment in terms of prestige, diplomatic access and potential arms sales that support British industry. But for others, those benefits seem to conflict with Britain's stated foreign policy goals in the Middle East, supporting political reform, accountability and human rights. Sandhurst may be marvellous for Britain, a country where the army is subservient to government, but Sandhurst is also seen by some as delivering militarily trained officers to countries where, in many cases in the Middle East, armies exist to defend not the nation, but the ruling family. Sandhurst say that the Royal Military Academy offers a gold standard in training and education that is recognised the world over, and that building international relations through military exchanges and education is a key pillar of the UK's international engagement strategy. At the moment, Sandhurst is winning the argument. I'm Matthew Teller, and the producer of Sandhurst and the Sheikhs was Karen Piri. It was a Whistledown production for the BBC World Service.